of the federal regulations in order for them to do that. And even if this were possible, I think it's an example of the philosophy of the federal regulations that everyone should be able to choose their own medical provider. The program, as they presented at that time, would have been very cumbersome, would have required some of the Medicaid recipients to travel some distance from their homes to get their prescriptions filled or refilled, in many cases requiring that they use taxicabs or at least common TriMets and that kind of transportation. The impact on some of the individual pharmacies would be felt by them, the fact that they would be losing some of the customers. We also think that there is possibility some breakdown in the quality of care that they receive. Many of the smaller pharmacies, individual pharmacies, independent pharmacies, do a tremendous job of patient consultation, which does not occur in a lot of the other pharmacies. We've got a lot of people want to testify behind me. I'll let go of that.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Adana Roberts, AFS. Mr. Roberts.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, again for the record, my name is Dana Roberts, Deputy Administrator of Adult and Family Services. We'd like to point out for your information that we currently have both a fee-for-service and prepaid capitation basis for the reimbursement of medical providers. That includes both health maintenance organizations and physician care organizations. In relation to this bill, the health maintenance organizations do restrict Medicaid providers to the pharmacies that are part of the health maintenance organization. What this bill in effect would do is remove that restriction, and as a result would very seriously question our ability to continue contracting with health maintenance organizations. A good example of that would be Kaiser in Portland. The previous speaker was talking about expanding that concept to basically a pharmacy provider organization. And while this bill would also restrict us from doing that, our biggest concern is the restriction it would have on our current health maintenance organizations, as well as trying to contract within a budgeted level with providers under standards established by House Bill 3013 and the task force.
Dana, there certainly is a distinction between a restriction on the use of whatever pharmaceutical services an individual wants when they are in a HMO or PCO and when they are not. Is there any particular advantage in a service which merely is merely a pharmaceutical program, capitation or something like that? Is there any particular advantage? Have you had any such contracts?
Not at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Are you contemplating any?
At one time we were, but right now the whole waivers on contracting is up for renegotiation with the federal government. It is one of the opportunities that we are asking for under the waiver. Whether or not they will allow us to really do that at this point, I don't know.
It might be advantageous if this bill were amended so that it did not apply to, so that the restriction did not apply to HMOs or PCOs. That's your major objection. The other is strictly speculative that you might consider the other, and we certainly haven't.
That is our major concern, Mr. Chairman. That is our major concern. We have made one other assumption in the pricing of the bill, which is zero at this point, and that is it would not affect our medical management program. And just to briefly educate you on that, for those clients that have a pattern, if you will, of potential abuse, we ask them to choose a pharmacy of their choice. And since this bill does in fact say that it's still up to the client to choose a pharmacy, we assume that this bill does not impact that program.
Well, I wouldn't want to pass this bill unless we had, unless it only applied to services other than HMOs and PCOs.
That's our biggest concern, yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Would the committee agree with that?
Yeah, what that tells me, though, that there must be some money to be made in pharmaceutical services in a PCO and an HMO. Is that correct?
It's
they're willing to contract for the service at our budgeted rates.
Because otherwise they wouldn't be concerned about it otherwise, would they?
It's like insurance. It's a capitation.
Yeah, they do it on volumes
a certain rate.
The main thing our interest should be, though, as a committee, is the accessibility to clients to get to this without having to hire it, get a taxi or drive halfway across town to get to a pharmacy. Isn't that our concern as a committee?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, Representative. And I, you know, my personal view is that's why you established the task force and put money as a reservation to deal with the whole pharmacy. Whether or not you need to specifically put it in law, you've got a number of shackles, if you will, on us now as far as how we proceed with really new ideas, if you will, in the pharmacy area. But it, again, it's your choice.
Art?
And I think there are, if I'm not mistaken, Dana, there are federal requirements on access.
That's correct.
And not only just drug services, but all of the services that are there. And I think the idea of the money to be made, it may be there, but the savings comes about through an HMO or PCO, of course, of not only volume, but of managed health care and doing preventive measures and simply the more services you include within managed health care like that. And under capitation, I think it's good, and the legislature has declared that when they passed House Bill 3013. I think it is a legislative policy to promote. And I would, you know, I would not think you would want to do anything that would restrict AFS being able, like you said, Mr. Chairman, to go out and under those PCOs and HMOs contract for drug services, or to put that under the coverage provided.
If you put those in here as an amendment, is there any other on the remaining clients that are not in those kind of organizations? Do you ever put restrictions on where they can get their drugs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, at this point, only under the medical management program, where we ask them to choose a pharmacy of their choice, which this bill we're assuming would not impact.
Potential abuse.
Yeah.
So they still would have a pharmacy of their choice, but they
That's
couldn't
correct.
Just go to
any pharmacy.
Any pharmacies.
I'd be glad, Mr. Chairman, if you
All
just
right.
want to look at those amendments.
Let's do that. There's no objection. We'll look at those amendments, and if they're satisfactory, we'll pass out the bill with those amendments. That takes care of that item for now.
Mr. Chairman, this is the vehicle that you and I have both, I think, selected for prenatal care. Because you need some enabling legislation, and because this bill relates to medical assistance, this would be your vehicle for whatever you may want to do with expanding prenatal care.
543.
So it's
All right.
It's a piece of legislation that ought to stay in committee until such time as you make the decisions on how far you're going to expand that program.
Is there another vehicle in case we decide to use this for the pharmacy people?
We can use it for both because it brought enough time. It says relating to medical assistance. It would be what you want to do with freedom of choice and prenatal care.
You know, we're beginning to talk about germaneness in terms of the content of the
yes.
bill and whether or not the content is diverse or similar enough. And although I realize the relating clause is broad, the content is reasonably diverse that we'd be putting into this. I wonder if it would make sense to put this content over into that other pharmacy bill that we just voted out
Merging.
Here, and then we have a free bill for the other.
Why don't you
hold
look at that and we'll check
for
out.
A while.
Yeah.
Suggestion. I'll just hold 531 for a day or so also then.
We probably have a Ways and Means bill anyway we could use that, don't we?
I have a look.
Don't have any, huh?
Just a matter. And I found 543 as being
just a matter of speeding up
time.
That's
right. All
right.
But I'll keep them both in committee then.
All right. You have us down here for public testimony on prenatal care proposal.
I think what you'd want to do in just a few minutes before you get to the civil commitment bill, Mr. Chairman, is let the Adult and Family Services Division respond back to you. You wanted to know staffing standards, and you wanted to know about the risk of the various client groups. So let them make a report to you and then go to your public
testimony. That's fine. That's a good idea.
And then this afternoon, we also need to start the testimony on the civil commitment.
All right, who do we have on there? All right, signed up on.
Why don't you start with Dana Roberts and his staff, and he'll give you two reports now on prenatal care, and then we'll get I'll circulate the sign-up sheet on prenatal care.
I hate to act so hectic here, but I want to be sure that we get as much in as we can in our limited length of time.
Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, my name is Dana Roberts, Deputy Administrative Adult and Family Services. And with me is Christine Gebbe.
There she is. She appears.
Yay!
Administrator of the Health Division. I will answer one of the questions you raised the last time I was before you, which is how did we actually calculate the staffing related to the prenatal care issue? Chris will then respond to the second question you asked, which was what is the risk as you move down into the various levels? First of all, in the calculation of the staffing, what I've handed out to you is basically a three-page paper that goes through how we calculate staffing impacts of programs or bills as they are introduced. Very briefly, what we try to do is estimate the total number of people that we would serve. In this situation, it was 21 months of the biennium. And the first item was under pregnant women, and item B indicates that we assume we would serve 3,118 of them over
where
the biennium.
Are you?
I'm on page 1B.
1B, all right, population served, thank you.
Okay. We would serve 3,118 pregnant women over the course of the 21 months. We assume that they would have an average time on assistance of 6 months.
Just hold just a second. How did you make the estimate of the number?
Okay.
I'm very supportive of this bill, and I want to be sure that I understand all the intricacies
sure.
of it in case people ask questions. No, it's all right. But unfortunately, we have five different circus rings that we're operating simultaneously in this closing days.
Okay. In the first year of next biennium, we estimate that the population that could apply under the bill is 2,100. We assume
they're sort of eligibles, right?
They're the potential eligible group. We assume 75% of them would actually apply and receive a medical card. And that's how you get to the 1,242 in the first year.
Okay.
In the second year, the population that's potential out there was 2,800 because it's 12 months versus 9 months. And we assumed in the second year that 85% of them would actually become eligible, which is 1,876 out of that 2,800.
Where'd you pull out those percentages?
Okay.
We're looking at how solid these estimates of cost
No,
are.
I understand.
All right.
We pulled out the percentages of 75% and 85% from looking at national data that says when you have a mature program, it is at 90%, but you don't build up there automatically. And so it was our assumption that you would have that type of phase in. But it's just mainly related to our experience in implementing new programs versus the national assumption that eventually you would have 90% of the potential group out there actually receiving care.
Okay, thank you.
We assume that during the length of the woman's pregnancy that they would average 6 months actually receiving service from us, and that would mean you'd have a turnover of 3.5 over a 21-month period. which means our monthly average, which is under 1D, would be 891 per month for that 21-month period. As far as the children that we would have to cover in order to provide prenatal care coverage, that starts with item 2 on the first page. And we go through the similar type of assumption building in getting an estimate of the number of children that would actually receive care on a monthly average for the next biennium.
And the first year of the biennium, age up to 2 would be eligible. The second year of the biennium, age up to 3 would be eligible.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
That's correct. And again, under 1B, it shows the estimate of the number of children in the first 9 months, which was fiscal year 88, and then the second 9 months, or the second year, which was a 12-month period, which is 4,941. And you can see how we calculated that out to get a monthly average for the biennium of 4,235.
Let me stop you just a second.
Sure.
Probably in some of these small numbers back here.
Uh-huh.
What sort of care is assumed here for the children?
Okay. The care for the children.
Amount to a number of visits and costs and so forth.
Okay. The care for the children is the full range of Medicaid services we provide to anybody else. The care for the mother is restricted to pregnancy-related services as well as delivery services.
What I'm going to backtrack. What does that full range consist of?
That includes physician coverage if they have a need for a physician, hospitalization, dental, X-ray. It also puts
preventive
them in
the
MediCheck screening program, which is the preventive program that we have under Medicaid, and puts them in their screening schedule.
Immunization and so forth.
Right.
Nutrition?
Not as much as we would like, but to the extent they have identified problem, then it would cover that also.
Provided by a doctor or?
By a doctor primarily.
Or public health nurse?
They could be referred to a nutritionist or a nutrition program. And that could be a billable service if it was defined as particularly related to some problem.
In every one of these cases, the services provided by the individual has a free choice as to who they can go for the service.
It would be our intent, Mr. Chairman, that if this program was initiated, that since it's related to ADC coverage, if you will, that we would probably ask the PCOs and the HMOs in the areas that we have them to consider this population. And if they did that, then it wouldn't be generally a freedom of choice in that area.
Was there some sort of condition? Did you want to come up?
No.
Was there some sort of condition that this be provided by both either public or private? Services?
Mr. Chairman, that relates back to the prenatal care and the case management portion of the proposal that you have before you. In order to get Medicaid coverage of that case management, we have to allow both private and public providers the opportunity to provide that service.
That's in the prenatal.
That's in the prenatal.
Same thing true of the obstetrical?
Yes.
But with reference to the care of the children, this could be contracted through an HMO or PCO.
If it was one under our waiver and two, they agreed to do it, but yes, it could.
Who agreed to it?
The HMO or the PCO.
Oh, okay. But not the individual?
Not the individual.
You could assign the individual under a contract?
We're assuming if we got our waiver adjusted from the federal government that we could.
Please interrupt anybody else. I get so intent on this, I don't look around to see if somebody else wants to do
a great job.
My only question is the average client family figure. You've got your 1.4.
Yeah, our next page, that's our next one. Three, tell us about how you arrived at that.
The key there is that client family figure. Where'd you get that?
Mr. Chairman, that figure we got from, that is the statistic or the average we have in our current medically needy program. we assume that these people...
Define medically needy for me in
lay terms. In lay terms right now, it is pregnant women and children up to 133 1/3% of the ADC standard, which means that for a family of three, you're at 133 1/3% of 397, so whatever that is.
But by definition, these medically needy and...
Yeah, 530.
Don't have kids? No, they are not eligible for ADC. Right. Because they are above the income level for ADC, but they are eligible on the medically needy program for a certain amount and certain kinds of medical care.
Who else is in medically needy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, right now it is only pregnant women and kids. The legislature, in acting on our bill for the next biennium, allowed expansion to cover non-pregnant adults. That's why we used their average as far as household size, because it is as closely reflective of who we're trying to cover above 133 1/3% is what we've got.
It just seems low.
Oh, you mean the size of the family?
Yeah, I would say.
Well, a high percentage of these families are in effect single parent ADC families. Yeah. That's why they're on ADC.
And
only two people in the family.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this 1.4 is only those people in a family that actually get a medical card, another way of saying it. There would be older kids in that family that wouldn't get any medical care. There would be non-pregnant adults in the family that wouldn't get any medical care.
Whoops.
Father.
The father.
Yeah, okay, the non-pregnant.
Or a mother who's not pregnant.
Is it up through five or up to five?
In the first year, it's up to age two, second year up to age three, and then eventually up to age
five. Well, let's face it, the lower this figure is, the more money you get for administration. That's what it comes down to, doesn't it? Is that right or wrong? True or false?
The lower this figure is, well, it depends on what the other figure up above represents. The reason why I say that is the other figure up above is only those that we give a medical card to. If I included up there, you know, all the people in the household, then that figure would change. So, you know, it depends on how you laid it up, I guess.
Let's have this whole exercise is to justify the administrative component of this program.
Well, that's what we're looking at, is seeing what the justification is. First, the people who would be excluded from this 1.4 figure, even if they were in the family, would be a father, for instance, because he isn't pregnant. A mother of a child up to two when the mother is not pregnant. And therefore, the only people included in the 1.4 is a pregnant woman and any child under the age of two,
in the first,
excluding all children above the age of two, excluding a father, and excluding any non-pregnant mother. That's how it gets reduced down to that level. And you have to recognize that a large percentage of this class are eligible for ADC because they are single parent families. So the administrative cost is based on the assumption that there is a certain caseload that is above which you shouldn't go, just an arbitrary figure, based upon the number of individuals whose eligibility must be determined every month in order to meet federal
reimbursement.
Well, that's all we're saying.
Yeah, no, I understand it completely. In fact, you just go to the next page, and 3661 cases divided by welfare case standard, 135 cases per physician equals 27.12 assistant.
Yeah.
Pretty straight math, but I not only question the figure here, but I also wonder about your 135 cases per physician. That's where I really had a question there. I don't think these cases are that complex, are they?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, our opinion is that they are less complex than the medically needy. That's why we did not use their standard. But
what is the standard for the medically
needy? You got the 135 case per position.
The standard for medically needy, which I have in the footnote at the bottom of page 2 of the caps there, is 1 to 115. We used 1 to 135 because the effort, if you will, that we have to do on this case is very similar to the effort we have to do on an ADC case. As far as the eligibility process we go through, the verification of income we go through, the determination of household size, looking at resources, et cetera, et cetera. So that is the standard that we use, which was 1 to 135.
What happens if we up it to 170?
Then you are putting us in the situation of if we can't be timely in providing the service, it's due to this lack of staffing. And you heard numerous testimony throughout the session that said that 1 to 135 was a standard that is way out of date, and in fact gave us direction to do
a
staffing standard.
Yeah, do you just not declare them eligible, or do you spend less time in every case?
It takes us the same amount of time, it just takes us longer to make them eligible. That's in effect what
there's
happens.
No way for them to, they have no efficiency. They're at their absolute max peak efficiency, no shortcuts, no nothing to be found. These people are stretched as thin as they can go.
That's what they've been telling me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Well, you've certainly detailed, I think, the basis upon which the administrative, the estimates are based, both for the number of people involved and the case load. All right?
Okay.
Now, is there more to be added here?
You had a second part of the report. All right. I wanted to talk about the risk. Remember the... started
yes.
at about 75% of the federal yes. poverty level, worked yourself up to 100%. Christine and her staff was going to try to say at what point did the risk become higher or lower on that.
Did you have a question, Mike?
I guess so. Dana, the 135, that includes the children.
That's correct.
And the only determination there is the age of the child. And I assume they're related to the family, but that'd probably go without saying.
No. Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have to, once we determine the child's age, we also have to go through and verify the family's income. We have to verify their resources.
Let me stop you. The 135 is 135 per eligible person or per eligible family?
The 135 is number of ongoing cases per worker in the branch.
Is a case... in the average family, 1.4, or is it 1?
The case in the average family is 1.4.
A case represents 1.4, so it represents
right.
a family,
right.
an average family.
Right. 135 ongoing average families, of which 1.4 people is eligible for medical care.
Okay.
But in... prenatal care isn't by definition, it'd have to be two, wouldn't it?
No.
You got a mother and a child.
Not until the child's born.
Right.
That's
and
what
it goes in, and if it goes, I don't think that math comes out. It goes until they're how old?
2 years.
Two years.
So in the first year,
first
3 years
three
in the second year of the biennium.
Average month center, how much?
For the mother during her pregnancy, we're assuming
that's 12, that's 9 months.
We're assuming 6 months on the average.
Okay, that's only 6 then.
For the children, we're assuming once they're eligible that they're generally eligible. The average is 21 months because the family's income changes.
Is the mother eligible after the child's born?
No, she's not.
Yes. This statement on the second page of your document, Oregon's postnatal death rate is very high.
Wait a second. We haven't even gotten to this one yet.
Yeah, I want to go there.
Well, I want to go just as soon as I get their questions about that first report. Okay. Let's move and let Christine go through this and then ask questions about it. Okay? Christine.
Okay. We did not succeed in getting you the chart, I think, that we envisioned as we were here.
Let me stop. Remind the committee, what I asked was to see if there could be a graphic representation of the alleged or the assumptions upon which this program is based as to its effect in preventing underweight, premature, and children who will have problems after birth.
The critical piece is included in the first three numbers at the top of the first page. On the average, 5% of births in Oregon are children of low birth weight. Low-risk mothers, who are mothers who are married, have a high school education, over 18, run a 3% rate. Medicaid-supported mothers run 10% of low birth weight, a rate of 10% of their births being of low birth weight. Low birth weight babies are very expensive. They tend to die in the first year of life. They tend to run up large hospital bills, cause a number of other problems.